Hello there, welcome to Life Matters. After the weekend, good morning. Natasha Mitchell joining you for the next hour on ABC RN off the back of a very interesting weekend over at the Festival of Dangerous Ideas over in Sydney, introducing speakers on the history of nuclear warfare and Chinese internet censorship. I was. And when the videos go up on the Sydney Opera House's YouTube channel, I'll point to them on the Life Matters Facebook page. Very, very interesting speakers and themes. Well, long live and prosper. Stories to help you do that this morning. In a moment, how the so-called Internet of Things might help you do that. And also, we're told to try and keep that weight down around our middle, especially as we age. It's a heart disease risk, we know that. But one nutritionist says the obsession with dieting, with lean menus, well, it's doing us harm.
We would see people come in and they'd be frail and malnourished and thin. And when we talked to them, they'd say things like, oh, well, you know, I knew I had to lose weight, so I lost weight. Or I've been, you know, for years and years, I mustn't eat fatty foods and all this sort of stuff. And what would happen is that they would come to us then as over a period of time of having lost weight. And when you're older, if you lose weight, you lose muscle. And that is the significant thing that makes a difference to what we're looking at.
So what should we eat? Nairi Robbins, nutritionist, is going to join us with a counterintuitive message based on her first-hand experience. And also on the show, as the world looks to the refugee crisis across Europe, and about time too, wouldn't you say? We'll be turning our attention a little closer to home and to what's happening to the Nepalese nearly 4 months on after that major earthquake. On Friday, it was the state of music education at school in Australia that we looked at, why it matters, why music literacy matters, and you're still talking to us about it all on our Facebook page with your stories. Here are some calls.
Hello, I'm Emma. I'm in Adelaide. I'm a music educator, and when Natasha asked what is at stake, for me, I believe that it's the musical literacy of the next generation that's at stake if we don't teach music in schools. The younger that we start, the better. And we need to remember that the children that we're teaching are the parents of the next generation who will inspire their own children musically. And for many of the listeners who rang in, they were describing how their love of music came from their home and from inspiring teachers. So the more that we can inspire adults and we can inspire the next generation of adults, the better. Thank you.
I think music education is really important from a scientific point of view. I guess I'm a great believer in the idea that music education is a different type of education that wires the brains of our children differently, and I think it's important for them to have a really balanced education.
Hi, my name's Isabel. I have to confess that I'm nobody's musician by any stretch of the imagination. However, I'm really passionate about all sorts of music, whether it be opera, a cappella, rock and roll, pop, anything. And I have identical twin daughters, 18 months. We started doing music from a very early age, doing the beats, and I lament the fact that statistics being bantered around, you know, particularly public school systems, the percentage of schools participating in the full music program is so low. The imagination of teachers to combine things such as art and music or literature and music and mathematics in particular and music is quite poor. We really do need to teach teachers differently as part of their training for them to understand that music is such a vital component of our life.
Yes, and also loving your stories on our Facebook page about music education. I'll just read this one. Gillian writes, my kids became musicians almost despite school music education. All four can play, though one chooses not to. Admittedly, they were brought up in a home where both parents played every day, but the formality of school music and lessons didn't work for them. My son particularly, who is working in a dispatch firm to help support his band, Hadel Moore is the name of his band, is another who played very well but couldn't name the chords for years. He can now. He composes, does the artwork for the band's CD covers and merch and the band tours extensively. As for me, I began at 27 and have been playing in bands ever since. So whilst I totally support music education, don't give up. if it is in the kids, in all likelihood, it will happen. So yes, worth going to our Facebook page to read some of those stories. From music literacy to computer literacy, and have you been left behind in the workplace? That discussion last week provoked quite a response too.
Hello, my name is John and I'm from South Australia. I was a commercial traveller with a suitcase travelling the outback for years and years. When I got my first computer, I just sat down and learned by the simplest lesson that I could find within the tiny little computer and taught myself how to be literate with a computer. And from then on, the business gradually became more computerized and I never, ever had a lesson. I did it all myself. And it's very easy. Don't be afraid of it. I just think if you're afraid of your computer, you're going to get left behind. You need to turn it on and play with it for a start. Don't do anything serious. Just play with it.
This is Colin. I believe the bedrock of computer skills is touch typing. I believe all kids should be able to touch type when they leave primary school. It is really the bedrock of being able to use a computer, especially in the workplace and in legal situations. Thank you.
And thank you, our listener feedback line, for your comments, stories, responses, arguments, debates, brickbats. Messages of love is 0283 1430, 0283 1430, or you can tweet us today at RN Life Matters. We'd love to hear from you. First up this morning, then, is another angle on how the intimate and ubiquitous nature of computers is evolving in our lives. I wonder if you've been watching the British series Humans, as I have. It's a spin-off, I'm told, of an even better earlier Swedish series, Real Humans, set in our world in the not-too-distant future where android humans have become our helpers. But have they become all too human? Are they making we of real flesh and blood redundant in our own lives? It's a really interesting series, and I'm going to hunt down the Swedish series now too. Now, that's a sci-fi scenario. But in 2015, we could be using smarter technologies a whole lot more efficiently to and effectively to enable our lives at home and beyond. If you're one of the 97,000 Queenslanders living with a disability, you might be feeling very frustrated right now that there's been little to no progress with launching the National Disability Scheme in your state. Here, though, is one positive development. Launching tomorrow is a new Queensland Community Care Smart Assistive Technology Collaborative. Now, what's that all about? It's a web portal, apparently, that will advise people, carers, users, on the latest in what's called smart assistive technology. And these technologies, devices, novel sensors, systems, sound very interesting, and I wonder if they mark the arrival in our lives of what some people have called the Internet of Things. To tell us more and hear for the launch is Dr. Kevin Doughty. He's director of the Centre for Usable Home Technologies at Coventry University in the UK. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us in the Brisbane studio. And also with you there is Dr. Eleanor Horton, a senior lecturer in nursing at the University of the Sunshine Coast, who joins us in that capacity, but also as a partner and a carer. Good morning.
Good morning.
Great to have you with us. Kevin, what's the essential concept behind smart assistive technologies?
I guess the word smart should say it all. It's not simply bits of mechanical or even electronic assistance. It's something which has a ability to communicate, to make decisions based on information that is collected. So really, instead of performing basic functions or basic activities that we need to live, things like bathing, feeding, toileting, it looks at those other quality of life issues that gives us our well-being. And that could mean anything from shopping, doing the laundry, managing finances, and simply having fun.
Well, as the conversation proceeds, we'll get to some really interesting examples. You've been actually in this field for over 30 years, I gather, running at one stage an aged care home with your wife. To inventing and advocating for smart technologies. How has this whole field changed over the years as technology has changed?
I think they've worked together rather well. As human carers have become a premium, both because there aren't enough people in a position of being a carer, the technology has matured, it's become smaller, it's become ubiquitous. As you've explained, that there is now the computing power in a smartphone that once required a big mainframe computer. And it's that combination of portable devices that we can carry with us, that we can fit in our houses, that have enabled these additional functions to be possible and in a way that isn't stigmatising.
So give us some examples of those sorts of functions. What are we talking about here? What's the interesting frontier that you're at?
I think there are frontiers at every level, from mobility through to living safely and securely and being able to get out. So on the mobility front, it really is a case of making sure that people are able to exercise as much as possible, almost to give them a competition, to push them to go that little bit further, but keeping them safe. So if they do suffer a fall, for example, not only can that be detected automatically, but someone would know exactly where they are so that they could be rescued.
So are you alluding to one of your pet projects, the so-called smart walking stick here?
Not in so many words, but certainly I think what we need is an interface, something which we could carry that doesn't tell the rest of the world that you are being monitored. So in the case of my smart walking stick, yes, of course, it knows where it is, but hopefully it would help people use it more effectively to prevent a fall. And in the case of someone who has limited cognition, guide them away from dangerous areas such as steps or stairs.
Just tell us about the smart walking stick, because it is a great example of what we're talking about here, because it can feel quite abstract, all this, so I'm keen to really give it some shape.
Well, it certainly can, because people expect these assistive technologies to be machines, whereas in practice we can convert almost any item that you use in the household to become smart. So in the case of a walking stick, it's providing the intelligence, providing the feedback and interface to give people advice. So in the case of the walking stick, it was based on my own father, who's 94, and his experience since his diabetes has probably worsened and his eyesight has deteriorated. He's taken to using a walking stick, but he doesn't use it correctly. He will forget it. He will carry it horizontally rather than vertically. Mm. And therefore, the benefits could be lost unless there is something which guides him. So that's where technology of this smart form can play an important role.
So, Kevin, what's actually in the smart walking stick?
Essentially, it's a computer, or more likely a tablet device, because a tablet computer contains all those sensing elements that we take for granted. It's got the microphone and the speaker, but it's got a display. It has GPS navigation. It can communicate electronically, and that's there almost for free. So if you can combine the functionality of a walking stick with the personal mentoring, as I call it, a smart assistant for mobility, or SAM for short, then there is a low-cost benefit and something which hopefully people will use without feeling that they are stigmatised in any way.
So hang on, does the smart walking stick actually talk back at him?
Oh, certainly.
You're not using me correctly.
Yes, and shout if necessary as well.
No! I don't want my technology to do that.
And it doesn't have to. That's the great thing about smart technology, is it's programmable, it's personal, and you make it do exactly what you or your carer wants it to do.
So it might say, now Roger, you haven't taken me. Roger, pick me up. Hold me properly.
Yes, indeed, it could.
That's extraordinary. I just wonder about the privacy issues of something like that too. Isn't it someone's own business as to whether or not they use technology or not?
Well, I think people will use it, and they'll use the right to ignore it as well. That's the real thing about technology. You can have all the advice. You can take the horse to water, but actually making it drink is another story. That's where I think we will retain our rights as humans to overcome that threat perhaps posed by the technology.
Mm, and has he happily adapted to it?
The word happy doesn't spring to mind, but he accepts it and understands after his 11th fall that he really should take better care of himself.
So let me come to you, Dr. Eleanor Horton, because this is intensely personal for you. Your husband, Patrick, experienced a significant stroke 15 years ago. Why then does this whole realm interest you in your and your husband's situation?
Natasha, in terms of health monitoring and health maintenance and maintaining independence, it's really important. And as Kevin said, when people sit down for a while, when they're disabled, they tend to lose some of their mobility function, and then they go to get up and they forget their stick.
Mm.
So having a stick that could say, hey, remember me, would really be advantageous to a lot of people, I imagine.
You've been involved in trialling, I think, a CSIRO-created device called Home Sensor. How are you and your husband using that?
We are part of the CSIRO Smart Home Initiative. We have sensors throughout the home that are relayed through to an iPad and through to his care provider. And that senses mobility, nutrition, hygiene, sleep, heart rate, weight. It gives an overall picture of health maintenance. And honestly, after 2 or 3 days, you don't even look at the sensors.
So just describe then the setup in your home. Like, is every room somehow connected back to base?
Yes, every room has a sensor.
Right.
But they're above the door. So, like, when you walk through a door, you don't automatically look up, so you're not aware of them. And they just feed straight to the iPad.
But what are they actually feeding? I mean, you've nominated a whole range of variables there. Mm. So, say, keeping an eye on nutrition and personal hygiene, for example. What happens?
Well, for nutrition, we've got a sensor in the kitchen, we've got a sensor on the pantry and the refrigerator, so that we can monitor if the fridge has been opened, if the pantry's been opened, if someone has had a meal or prepared a meal. That's all monitored. If someone has had a shower, if they've entered the ensuite but haven't exited or been in there for an hour, then an alert can be sent through. So the majority of falls do happen in the bathroom area, so it's really important that, you know, if you know someone goes into the ensuite, you also need to know they go out.
Now, why was your husband particularly okay about being observed in this way?
That's ironic, because he's a Foucauldian scholar who was a French philosopher. So, but the fact that it isn't visible, it's not something that you're conscious of all the time. You just forget it's there.
But what's key is that it is enabling you. Many times carers have to leave the workforce or the full-time workforce to dedicate 100% of their time to their loved one, their partner, after a stroke or similar. You have been able to maintain a professional working life whilst also feeling connected to your husband's needs. Is that right?
Yes, and it's been really helpful. And as he ages and technology improves, then more and more links can be made to the platform.
It's intriguing to me, Kevin Doughty. We're talking about smart assistive technologies. Tomorrow in Queensland, a new initiative will be launched, Queensland Community Care Smart Assistive Technology Collaborative. What a title. Where do they come from? Kevin, you're here for the launch.
I am.
I guess, what other examples are there that you can speak of? We've talked about a sensory home that kind of documents our movements and our needs. We've talked about a walking stick that talks back to us to enable us to stay upright and mobile. What other areas are there?
I think you can look at anywhere where there's a functional problem. So it could be a lack of speech, and there are other ways of generating speech. People can even use their breath these days to convert their thoughts into speech. People who can think something can actually control materials, and this is yet another area where this technology, the smart technology, makes a difference. In fact, if you look at all human functions and where there is some sort of problem, whether it's intellectual, whether it's sensory or cognitive. I think the technology is already in place to replicate the function performed directly, perhaps by the hands or feet or by the mouth, and to interface, therefore, with a device that can translate it into a form that can be replicated by generation of speech or sound or by moving objects. So the person who is paralysed could indeed start moving objects, and therefore their reliance on human carers could be reduced. I'm not saying that there's no place for human carers,
no,
because
this
I think that's
issue,
really important.
People feel concerned that these are sort of techno-fix solutions where what we need is actually people looking after people.
We do, but those people need to work in a smarter way. And I think some of the most successful smart assistive devices make the carer more efficient, reduce that burden that sometimes they feel, and which physically they feel as well, because carers are probably more prone to illness than other members of the public. So assistive technologies really do help society, they help the individual, and they help their carers in so many ways that it would probably be wrong to try and focus on a single application, because I think the technology has developed so much over the last decade in particular that almost every problem that people or issue that people can raise, there may be a solution or something which at least makes it safer for them to perform the task or makes them feel more secure or indeed improves their well-being and self-esteem.
Let me just come finally to Eleanor Horton. What's interesting here is the question that strikes me is how accessible are these technologies? You're involved in the Smart Home Initiative of CSIRO. That's how your house has been wired up. But how available are smart assistive technologies in Australia?
Natasha, the benefit of the CSIRO development is that it is wireless and it is all standard equipment that can be brought in any electronic shop and set up. So for care provider agencies to develop these initiatives, it isn't a huge expense for the benefit that they would receive. So with the disability platform that's being released, it works hand in hand that all these resources will be in the one place to benefit those who are disabled or aged in the community.
So this portal is an information portal, or is it a way of accessing the services?
The disability portal is a database of all services available.
Okay. Kevin, how do you see Australian progress on this front?
I see it rapid. Back in the UK, I think austerity has been the driver. I think it's for technology of this type. In Australia, I think it's a more planned program, and that means that consumers will be able to find out what's available. They'll be able, through the platform, not only to provide to find the provider, but also to recognise which technologies might work for them, because this is going to introduce far more choice, and choice will introduce competition, improve quality, and will ultimately, I believe, make the lives of disabled people more successful and enable them to perform things that they really didn't think they'd be able to do previously.
The Internet of Things has definitely arrived in our lives. And this is a Queensland resource, but people will be able to view it nationally, obviously, given that it's a web portal. Hopefully it might become national.
Indeed. I think we'll see national, we'll see international, and those barriers will be broken down. And the Internet of Things, as you suggest, this is one very useful example of Internet of Things technologies.
Thank you so much for making the time to join us. Good luck with the launch tomorrow. Dr. Kevin Doughty, Director of the Centre for Usable Home Technologies at the Universities of, well, Newcastle, Coventry and York, in fact. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
And Dr. Eleanor Horton, Senior Lecturer in Nursing at the University of the Sunshine Coast. Thank you for sharing how you and Patrick, your husband, are using this technology.
Thank you, Natasha.
And they're in Brisbane to help launch the Queensland Community Care Smart Assistive Technology Collaborative. It's all happening on Tuesday at the Royal International Convention Centre, and hopefully we'll be able to put a link to that portal at some stage later in the week when it's made live. Yes, indeed, the Internet of Things has landed. Life Matters is where you have landed as well, here on ABC RN. Great to have your company today. Up next, eating well, but not eating too leanly after you're 60.
Hi there, Sarah Kanoski here. Now, Books and Arts came to you live from the Brisbane Writers' Festival. We heard Laurie Penny on modern feminism, took a look at what drugs really do to your brain, considered the new generation of male writers sharing some very personal stories, and took a look at the hidden relationship between crime and mateship. If you missed it, you can podcast the program anytime from Books and Arts at the RN homepage.
Took it home, took it home, took it home. Ooh.
I don't eat no ham and eggs, cause they're high in cholesterol.
Come on, come
they don't
on.
Fight,
do you eat them?
No tip, do you eat them?
Hey.
Not at all.
Again.
I don't eat no ham and eggs, cause they're high in cholesterol. You're old feet, do you eat them?
Nope, shot, do you eat them?
Nope, not at all.
Hey.
Ah, when was the last time you ate a big giant plate of ham and eggs? You might have your own version of ham and eggs, of course, halloumi and hash browns might be more my thing. But as you get older, I wonder if you find yourself watching what you eat just that little more closely. You could become more and more obsessed about the spread around your middle, because we're told to keep the weight off there especially. It's indicative of cardiovascular risk. Nairi Hobbins is a dietitian specialising in nutrition for people 60 and above, and she's really concerned that increasingly people in that age range are eating like body-conscious 20-year-olds, and it's putting you into aged care unnecessarily. That's a big claim, but she believes she's seen hundreds of people in this situation eating to lose or keep off weight, and it's ruining their bodies and their ability to live independent, well lives, she says. Nairi is a clinical lecturer at the Wiking Dementia Research and Education Centre at the Uni of Tasmania. She's the author of Eat to Cheat Ageing, and she joined me a little earlier.
Good morning, Natasha.
So, in fact, you began to notice this trend amongst your clients or patients when you were living and working around the Central Coast in New South Wales. What did you start noticing?
It's one of those things that, it's not that I noticed the trend, I think it's that I became more and more frustrated with the trend. I think dietitians and health professionals for a while have known that people often end up frail and malnourished in hospitals and in aged care. And there's more and more evidence showing that. But what I saw really more and more commonly was that when I talked to people who arrived in the hospital where I was working with this fantastic geriatrician, we'd see these people and you'd talk to them and you'd look back over the last sort of 10, 15 years of their lives. And when you had a chat to them, you found that they were doing things that were fine actually for people who are 30 or 40, but as you get older, unfortunately, your muscles in your abdomen slacken a bit. Mm. And so even if you're not carrying a lot in the way of fat around your middle, it tends to look a little bit like that as well. So that while there's a lot of emphasis on you must keep your abdomen, you know, lean and whatever.
And rightly so, based on good evidence.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, and certainly, for I have to premise this whole thing by the fact that not that long ago, 70 was really old. You know, 100 years ago, 70 was life expectancy. So that nowadays, 80 and probably 90s, and lots of people are going to live into their hundreds. So the thing is that if you only had to live till 70, then most of the health messages that are around that apply very well and completely appropriately to people who are 30, 40 or 50, like you must not become obese and you must keep yourself fit and well and keep your, you know, and strong and healthy and keep your abdomen down. All those health messages are completely appropriate for that age group, but unfortunately they translate not very helpfully all the time when you're older, because we're looking at a different physiology and a different, you know, you need to be able to make yourself live well.
So what were you seeing in that hospital?
So what we were
seeing,
we would see people come in and they'd be frail and malnourished and thin, and when we talked to them they'd say things like, oh, well, you know, I knew I had to lose weight so I lost weight, or I've been, you know, for years and years I've been, I mustn't eat fatty foods and all this sort of stuff. And what would happen is that they would come to us then as over a period of time of having lost weight, and when you're older, if you lose weight, you lose muscle. And that is the significant thing that makes a difference to what we're looking at.
Let's come back to that. But this was actually people being body conscious in a way that means they've taken health messages on board.
Yes.
But is part of this also that people, if you look at the number of people living below the poverty line on the pension, is part of this that people have to budget and so they simply can't afford to eat large quantities as well on the pension?
Absolutely. And it's not so much large quantities, it's that is an enormous problem, for a social problem, that people are not able to access good food. There are a lot of people living alone. There are a lot of people whose partner has passed away and the partner was the person who cooked. I see a lot of older men, and I know that's it's a statement that it's not just older men, but in fact a lot of the time if their wife, who's always been their cook, has passed away and they're on their own, they don't know what to do. They don't really have the skills to do that. So you're left with people who don't have access to good food, you're right. And there's this thought of, people will think, oh, well, I don't need as much food because I'm older and I'm sitting around, whatever. But the problem is you need the same amount of nutrients. You may not need the same, feel like you need the same quantity of food, but you need the same amount of nutrients. And in fact, you need more of some, because you need to fight the ravages of age, basically.
What do you need more of?
You need more protein, so that per kilo body weight, people need more protein when they're older, because you've got a whole lot more just wear and tear. You know, your skin is more frail, so you can easily, there are tiny things, but you can easily scratch more easily, and the repair work has to be done. And it's quite normal to replace your body organs. You're always building new cells. As you get older, little bits of wear and tear and damage increase the rate at which that happens, and you get less able to do it efficiently. So that if you add extra protein, you can actually bolster that up a little bit. And there's a whole lot of other things. Your immune system needs protein. All these things are using up extra protein. So you need extra, and you need a few extra vitamins. But if you eat a range of foods, you get them without having to think about it. It's not, people don't have to take tablets, for example. But
your key argument is what's healthy in your younger years may not apply later on, that your physical and dietary needs change as you age.
Yes.
And you shouldn't necessarily shy away from fat.
No. Look, it depends on your age. Of course, if you're, you know, 60 and you're fit and healthy and you're running around and doing stuff, and maybe even if you're 60 and you're carrying a bit of extra weight, then certainly at that stage there's no advantage to having a bit of extra fat in a diet. In fact, it's probably a problem. But if you're 85 and you're, you know, starting to get a little bit frail, starting to have struggles with the appetite, and that is so common. People struggle with their appetite. So what happens is that if you eat the sort of the treat foods and the higher fat foods and the foods basically in the state as close as possible to the way they came off the land or out of the animal or whatever, and that means that when you eat your meat, it usually will have some fat on it and whatever, that seems to help keep your appetite going. And, you know, I can't imagine a time when my appetite's going to defeat me, but I know it's going to happen because it happens all the time. There's a whole lot of physiological changes that make that happen.
Nairi Hobbins is with us. She's a dietitian specialising in nutrition as we age. She's the author of Eat to Cheat Ageing. Her concern is that increasingly she's seeing people in their 70s, 80s, 90s who aren't eating enough, basically, for various reasons. And one of them might be that they've been encouraged to keep the weight down around their middle because of the cardiovascular risk associated with that. What happens when we lose weight when we're older? We lose muscle, as you suggested. Mm. And what are the consequences of that?
It's a really interesting thing. I'll just give you a very basic explaining of what muscle does. What happens all the way through your life is that you eat protein foods and they are what builds your muscle, but they also support your immune system. They also do all that organ repair work I was talking about. They also provide a background fuel for your brain, because if your brain doesn't have an adequate supply of glucose, it's not possible to convert fat into glucose. So if you need the glucose, you take it from protein and you convert that, and that goes into your brain. So there's a whole lot of things that are drawing protein, but you don't eat all the time. So what happens is, in the times that you're not eating, and that can be between meals or overnight or if you're having a fast or if you're, you know, having to fast for a medical procedure, Your muscles provide the protein that's needed to back up all those systems that are happening all the time, because they don't stop just when you're not eating. So there's a normal process your whole life where the muscles give up a little bit of protein, and as soon as you eat, it goes back again. The problem happens is that when you get sort of late 60s, 70s and on, you have slightly higher needs for protein and you get not as good at putting the protein back. So what happens is that you gradually can lose muscle. Now, for a while, it doesn't matter because you've got a large muscle reserve. But after some years of that happening, you can end up in a state where your immune system is being hampered and where organ repair starts to dwindle and where the amount of fuel you can provide your brain can be all in small amounts affected, and gradually that then increases over time, so that what happens is that people end up in this state where they're diminishing. And if you lose body weight when you're younger, in general what happens is you lose a mixture of fat and muscle, and that's always the case, but it's actually easy to put the muscle back, so it doesn't really matter.
But it's harder when to do.
But as you get older, it's
when we're
problem.
Over 70.
And the evidence will show that when you lose weight when you're older, you always lose muscle, and that is, then you start to weigh up what's the lesser of the evil, and the lesser of the evil is losing the muscle to keep your immune system going. So, yeah, it's a very interesting physiological thing. You can get around it by doing very good exercise, but it has to be very good and it has to be targeted, and you have to lift weights.
You have some great case studies that illustrate your argument. One of them is 82-year-old John, not his real name, but you encountered him in an aged care home in Tassie last year. He'd been a farmer his entire life, and what did you witness?
Well, he was one of these big men, a big, sort of loud, you know, vibrant farmer.
Heavy set, on ran a cattle
heavy
farm.
Set, exactly. And one of the farms that they have in Tasmania where there's lots of hills. So that you're working really hard. Now, he had probably been overweight most of his life, but the time he had to lose weight would have been when he was younger. So when he got to his late 70s, he had trouble with his knees, which is understandable. What his advice that he decided to take is he would lose weight. And unfortunately, someone had been on a very low-fat, low diet, and so he had decided to take it up. Now, he managed to lose lots of weight, but the problem was what he lost was lots of muscle, and he started to then have a series of health problems which just panned out over a period of time. And by the time I saw him, he was very frail, and he actually passed away soon after. Now, he had health issues, so it could have been a whole combination of things, but if he hadn't have been malnourished as well, he would have had a much better quality of life. And
he was taking low calorie diet shakes at the recommendations of a family member.
Unfortunately, yes. And you know, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with those particular, but unless you have a high protein diet combined with extremely good, well-targeted exercises, and you really have to get a bit of advice around that if you're very old, you're going to lose muscle. And in his case, the muscle degraded. His various other health problems then were made worse. He couldn't fight off a couple of infections that he has, so he got a bad flu and he got a few things. And your body just cannot keep up.
Interesting correlation.
It's tragic.
Here. And then there's the case, of 85-year-old Jim. And he had a love of steak and ice cream, hopefully separately. But his doctor advised that he take them out of his diet. And what did you see happen?
Well, yeah, and that had been years and years before. And I actually hear this so often, you know, I say to people something and they say, oh, well, my doctor told me in 1978, you know, to give up the X, Y, or Z because of my cholesterol and heart attack. And you go, yes, that is great. But you are now 87 or whatever you happen to be. Jim was 85, but you know, you're now 87, and this is a different situation.
But aren't those issues still just as potent in our 70s and 80s? Heart disease risk and diabetes risk?
Yes. Well, actually, you know, the whole thing, I keep on mentioning exercise, and you know, I should be an exercise physiologist because the whole thing comes down to exercise. If I look back and I sort of think about my grandparents' generation, you know, you had to be muscly and strong and fit in order to just live. You know, most of my grandparents had to, you know, chop wood to just get a cup of tea, and you know, and the washing, my goodness, the washing weighed 3 tons to get it out to the line. My washing's almost dry by the time it comes out of the washing machine. So they had to be physically fit just to live. So, and we don't have to be because we've got so many lovely labour-saving devices. Now, I don't want to give up my washing machine, but I have to go to the gym to have muscles or do something that make my muscles work.
So true.
And your muscles are going to keep you going. but people, you know, get into the habit of parking close to the shops, using the remote control for everything, you know, all those things. So if you don't do something about your muscles, they will let you down, and you have to eat protein and you have to exercise. So that all those things that you mentioned, yes, it's really important. It's really important in your 40s and 50s to get your weight down, because by the time you're in your 70s, you really can't do it safely unless you've got a really good program.
Therefore, those who are hanging down the local RSL having a steak sandwich and a Sunday roast are probably doing a good thing. Now, what about the vegetarians amongst us, though? And I'm putting my hand up at that point.
And I always say to vegetarians, look, you just have to find
high protein elsewhere.
Yeah, you just have to be really vigilant, because if you lose weight when you're, you know, beyond your 70s, or 70 plus, you will be losing some muscle. So if you unintentionally lose weight, that's a bad sign. So for any older person, if they lose weight without meaning to, and what I hear all the time is you feel virtuous when you've lost weight, because you've been told for all your life, you must, you must, you must. And then you get people who are in their 70s, and it's terrible being a dietitian, because when you're young, people are going, lose weight, lose weight. And then when you're 75, someone comes to me and they go, well, I've lost some weight. And I go, no! You know, you can't win. But the thing is, it's really important to be aware that things are different. And I just say to people, you know, I wrote the book to say to people, for heaven's sake, don't listen to health messages, don't apply.
So what needs to be on a person's dinner plate? Just what should the plate look like?
I always say put a protein food at the centre of each meal, and that's any sort of protein. So that's meat and fish and chicken and eggs, or tofu or halloumi or nuts and seeds. That's your protein. You put that at the centre of the meal, and then you surround it with as many different colours as you can.
Huh.
You don't have to think very much beyond that. You don't have to think about this much bread and this much olive oil. Olive oil, if you have it, you know, the green stuff, it's got antioxidants in as well, you know, the extra virgin. If you add as many different colours, you get antioxidants, and they protect your cells from damage.
Mm, that's great. So a colourful plate with a source of protein slapped in the middle in one way or another. And it's eat to cheat ageing. Noru Hobbins, thank you so much for joining us on Life Matters this morning.
Pleasure. Thank you, Natasha. It's been a treat.
And that's her book, Eat to Cheat Ageing. Noru Robbins is a clinical lecturer at the Wiking Dementia Research and Education Centre at the University of Tasmania. She's a nutritionist, and I love her vision of a colourful plate. The more colourful, the better. Interested in your thoughts about her comments, we'll pop a post on the Facebook page for you to add your thoughts to. On Life Matters, Natasha Mitchell with you. Remember Nepal? What's happening there 4 months after the earthquake? Coming up.
There's Mowgli from The Jungle Book and Tarzan in fiction. But this week on Animal People, real cases of children raised by animals.
Aren't you fascinated by the idea that a child might be living alone in a jungle and their best friend is a bear or a wolf?
That's Animal People. You'll find us on the RN homepage.
Yes, it's been almost 4 months now since Nepal was rocked by two earthquakes that left 8,500 people dead. 8,500 people. And as the world's attention turns to the refugee crisis across Europe, we want to turn our attention to the Nepalese and where things are at with their recovery right now, because it's monsoon season in Nepal. For the 2.8 million people displaced by the disaster, times are very tough. Many are languishing in camps in squalid conditions. Kathleen Walsh is a Red Cross aid worker. She's just returned from Nepal, where she's been working as a gender and diversity advisor in the disaster zone. And we wanted to get a sense from her about her work, but also what's happening on the ground right now. And she joins us this morning in our Melbourne studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Natasha.
How are you? There's building noise going on around you there.
Apparently it's okay, though.
you've just recently returned. Can you describe the scenes that you were witnessing as you were working on the ground with communities?
Yes, I've been back a couple of weeks now, and certainly, you know, people are really doing it tough in Nepal. It's a lot of people in very remote rural communities, kind of perched on the sides of mountains, if you like. And so, I mean, you talked about a couple of million people affected and displaced. And so it's, It's a really difficult time. The monsoon you mentioned as well, which is on now, and when the monsoon finishes, it becomes winter. So there's still a few months ahead of really difficult circumstances for people.
Is it true that it's one of the toughest monsoon seasons they've had? I mean, notwithstanding the situation after the earthquake, but also just the nature of the monsoon this year?
Look, I believe that's the case, and I think, you know, what the earthquake has done is made the land more susceptible to things like landslides, for example. So there's an added risk on top of what might have already been, you know, a difficult season.
Why 4 months after the earthquake has the Nepalese government not yet spent any of the $4 billion in donations that they received?
Oh, gosh, that's a tricky question. There is cash programming happening. That's been happening for quite a few months now. It will increase as the building increases. But as I said, you know, it is a really tough environment. So the recovery will be self-led. There won't be huge building projects by organisations like we might have seen in other disasters. Mm. But, you know, communities will need to get on with that building process themselves. And so as that kicks in and as materials are available and moved into some of these really remote areas, bearing in mind that some people live, you know, days walk from a road or from a township. So getting materials in there for roofing materials and rebuilding materials is a huge logistical exercise.
So Kathleen, what conditions are people living in now?
People are still living under tarps and in tents, and there's I think there were over 500,000, half a million houses totally destroyed, with another 300,000 damaged. Even those that are damaged, people are fearful to move back into them because they don't know what's going to happen. There are still lots of aftershocks. As you said, there were two earthquakes, so it places extra risks for people, I think.
The whole psyche of a nation changes after an earthquake, doesn't it? That fear. Oh.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm. Now, your focus is on women, and we've touched on the needs of women in Nepal briefly before around the time of the earthquake. Why, from your perspective, does special attention need to be paid to the plight of Nepalese women right now?
Well, for me, I was working with all the shelter providers, both national organisations and international organisations, about, you know, trying to ensure that they do pay attention to the needs of women and to other people with special needs. So, for example, people with disabilities and the aged, and to not just take a blueprint approach to what people might need. One of the issues that that drove quite a lot of my work is something I wasn't really that familiar with before I went to Nepal, is that there's a huge population of men from Nepal working overseas in some parts of Asia and in the Middle East. And so for women rather, you know, that's going to place incredible burdens upon them on top of what are already the implications of an absentee workforce. So, for example, you know, women in villages and in the community very much follow traditional roles and have the roles and responsibilities for family and community. With husbands, men working overseas, there's the added burden of working the gardens and the farm and looking after the livestock. And now the rebuilding, a lot of that will fall to them.
On to women.
Yes, and there's a huge labour, because of this absent overseas workforce, there's going to be a huge labour shortage as well. So my work and working with other people who are going to be working in shelter is, you know, how can we, you know, what's the most effective ways of working with and training women around rebuilding?
So you've got hundreds of thousands, I gather, of single women households because men have gone offshore, working abroad in India and further afield in order to send money back to their communities. And so what are the specific training programs that you're trying to implement for women who, it sounds like, are going to be responsible for the rebuild?
Well, that's right. And so, I mean, I think if we didn't pay a particular focus on women's needs and those other responsibilities that they've got in their lives, you know, it would be easy to say, well, let's make sure that, you know, there are there are training carpentry training programs for women, or as more is probably the case for Nepal, given the materials of traditional houses, masonry training. Now, is that really the most effective way of training women?
Mm.
Are they really going to be the masons and rebuild the houses from the ground up? No, I don't think so, and nor do a lot of other people. But how can we train women to build back better? How do they know if they've got to engage someone to put the roof on that they're doing a good job? How can we, if they're going to be responsible for the cash grants, how can we make sure that, you know, they budget in a way that means they don't run out of money halfway through the rebuild? How do they use tools safely and health and safety around the sorts of things that they will need to do?
So intensely practical. Not necessarily all the hands-on aspects, but definitely the managing of what needs to happen during a rebuild. In some sense, is this an opportunity to address the fact that women in Nepal have had much less education than their male counterparts in their communities?
Yes, absolutely, that's right. And they're not used to sitting sitting in school and learning in that way. So how do we take the training to them in the community? So doing that training at the village level, bearing in mind that, you know, if they are participating in training, someone still needs to be at home looking after the children and the animals. Not putting in training that goes from 8 in the morning till 4 at night.
Yeah.
So really refocusing our thinking around training, making sure that it's linked to livelihoods. You know, if childcare is what's needed, then maybe someone can be paid to do that childcare.
How difficult has it been in doing this work in attempting to reach women so as to train them? In terms of just the landscape of Nepal after the earthquake, you've mentioned that many people are living in very remote communities, very hard for you to get to as an aid worker.
That's right, and walking up and down hillsides,
yeah. slipping, falling up and down hillsides.
Very early in the monsoon season, roads were already, you know, very inaccessible, bogged, flat tyres in the mud. It was tricky getting out to some of the communities, and look, interestingly, you know, I mean, overall, we might, you know, if you look at the statistics, it might say, I think they say anywhere between 19 and 25, 26% might be women-headed households. But in some of the communities I visited, it could be as high as 50 or 60%. And so who you've got living in those communities is women. You've got the very young and the very old.
Are women go on.
Oh, and with small babies, lots of pregnant and lactating women as well. But, you know, they were really keen and enthusiastic about this skill development and in these ideas around different ways of training them.
And are the men in their lives or absent from their lives supportive of them taking on this renewed leadership role in the community?
I think that's
a formal leadership role?
Yeah, look, I think that's always going to be a tricky issue. And so part of the training is also to engage with community leaders and with men, and to really do some of that gender sensitization at the community level as well will be a critical factor in any training programs.
What are the priorities? As people are listening now and thinking, what can we do? What, mm-hmm. I've made my donation, is that enough? What can people do?
Well, it is still... it's going to be years in this recovery program. So if people, do want to continue to support Red Cross, you can look at the website, redcross.org.au. And the Australian community has been incredibly generous, as you say. And so Red Cross is very, very thankful for the support.
Well, we'll have to keep an eye on Nepal throughout winter. It's very scary living under a tarp in a freezing, freezing winter. It's a very worrying situation for the Nepalese. Kathleen Walsh, thank you very much for taking the time to join us today on the program.
Thanks for the opportunity, Natasha.
Kathleen Walsh is Gender and Diversity Advisor with Red Cross, just recently back from Nepal. And perhaps you've even been to Nepal off the back of the earthquake and you'd like to share a story with us. You can do that on our website or indeed on our Facebook page. I'd really like to hear from you if you've got a perspective, or perhaps you've had a long relationship with Nepal and you're concerned about their plight. Books and Arts Daily coming up
very shortly, what's cooking?
I'll tell you what's cooking. If you buy one of those little penguin reprints, you know, those rather attractive little orange-covered reprints, on the back, most of them have got a story about how Sir Alan Lane invented the paperback. He was in a railway station one day looking for something decent to read, and there was just nonsense, just, you know, dross on sale. And he thought, what we need are good books in cheap paperbacks. Apparently, he did this. This is in the 30s. That's the myth of Sir Alan Lane. In fact, it's all tosh.
Oh.
Not true. So we've got to find out what really happened. There were three Lane brothers, it turns out, and together they created the Penguin paperback.
Well, the history, and gosh, it's all changed again, hasn't it, now with people's, you know, portable reading devices. Books and Arts with Michael Cathcart, and they did a great interview with Will Self, coming up 10 a.m.